Welcome to episode 35, Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
Okay, so we're recording today, May 8th, 2016.
Yep. Administrative stuff first. We forget mentioning that we're using the old Samsung microphone.
Yes.
Just lately, in being super busy, it's sped things up.
It has.
Even though I don't think it sounds as nice.
No.
So, but it's helped me to just get through the podcasts.
Right.
We are so under so much time pressure trying to do so much.
Yeah.
So I think it still sounds okay.
Yeah, I think so. I think it does.
I think we're going to have actually a guest today. I noticed on Audacity, we left the door open, usually have it closed. I think Basil.
Oh, yes.
The green cheek Conyers getting picked up when he squawks.
Squawks, yeah.
And I think he's squawking more because he can hear us. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he'll be commenting. Oh, there he is.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody could hear.
Yeah.
Do we have any other... Well, we're recording this late.
Yes, we are.
But I think less late than last time, and it was on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were off at Bear Island.
Right.
With some kids, and the last one was a bit late, so... So, but it's not super late or anything, just 4 days. And probably next time we'll be back on our schedule. So... What do you want to do?
Okay. Why don't we start with...
What do you want to do?
I know. Why don't we start with some science articles? So...
Okay.
Would you like to start with biology or...
Sure.
Okay.
Is this one of yours?
Yeah. So this is one that's a follow-up from the moths and their sonar clicks.
Uh-huh.
And they've just finished doing another study... on the tiger moths, and they were looking specifically at the red-headed moth and the Martin lichen moths, and they were trying to see if the bats were avoiding them because they gave off a sonar click and that indicated that they were poisonous to bats, or if the sonar clicks actually kept bats back because it confused them because of these clicks that they were making. And in their most recent study, they found that 64% of the red-headed moths and 94% of Martin lichen moths that did not have the sonar clicking ability were eaten and spit out by the bats. And so they inferred from this that those strong clickings is actually setting up a strong warning to predators.
It's a little bit like colors
on
some insects that are poisonous.
Yeah. So it's...
Oh, do you think they'll find mimics? Like if you're a moth that's not poisonous.
Yeah.
You could click.
Click. Yeah, if you somehow developed that clicking thing.
Yeah.
I can't imagine why not, because we see that happen in nature so often.
Yeah, yeah.
So, who knows? But it's just a neat little finding, and it's nice the way they're working through this study. So I just...
Yeah.
Very short article. It was published May 6th, 2016, by Linda Zajac.
Well, she's a news reporter.
Yeah,
right?
News reporter.
This is on the science website.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, by the way, did you see the baby dinosaur that you talked about last time? It made it.
Oh, did it?
In the, I think, March 29th, I think.
I'll be reading it this week, probably. I'm a little behind.
Wait, are we in April?
April 29th, probably.
We're in May.
Yeah.
Right now. Okay. That's right. Yeah. Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah. Okay. I have no biology, actually.
I only
have two articles.
I have one more. Can you imagine what it is? Oh, CRISPR. CRISPR. So right now, there's a bunch of scientists gathering for an annual meeting devoted to gene therapy in Washington, D.C. And one of the focuses that they have is the discussion on CRISPR. And I just want to, I didn't read this so well, but I'd like to give you a few highlights of what I found. And I thought it was interesting. So get this. This year's meeting includes 93 abstracts on CRISPR of the total 768, right? Mm-hmm. Compared to only 33 last year. You know, just to think of the amount of research that's being developed because of this new technology. And I just thought, you know, when you see numbers like that, it starts to...
So I'm looking over at your, over on your screen, and it says specifically 93 abstracts on CRISPR.
Right.
But that, I mean, most people aren't studying CRISPR to study CRISPR.
Right. Yes.
I mean, so I did my first experiment last Friday using materials that someone got by using CRISPR.
Nice.
I don't think CRISPR, I mean, there's no way CRISPR is going to show up in the abstract.
No.
That's not the point. But yeah. So, and it's a guy who's just in the building, and this has been a longstanding trauma, and I'm not going to talk about it, but I can imagine there's just tons of those other abstracts, those 760, that CRISPR was used as part of it, but it's not even mentioned because it's, you know, that's not the scientific question.
Right.
They use CRISPR to create something that would then answer their question.
Right. And I thought the interesting things of, you know, kind of what is it being used right now for? CRISPR is being used to treat animals that have inherited liver disease and muscular dystrophy. And there will be more such preclinical reports during the meeting.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting to see what they found. And because of it being used, you know, on living organisms and seeing the success rate that they've had.
It's also really exciting to wonder what major questions in biology would have just not been able, haven't been tackled simply because, they've been tackled, but it's been just too difficult. And with CRISPR, nothing to do with therapeutics. It's just so easy to do modification of the germline or of cells that some of these... So in our case, it's cells, they produce two different proteins. And we can find cells that produce only one. And so when we want to study the protein, and the proteins are very similar and they're very difficult to isolate and because they're gigantic. So we haven't been able to isolate absolutely pure of one versus the other.
Yeah.
And so we couldn't study them independently. Well, this guy just took some cells, it was a cancer cell, knocked out one, took the other cell, took the same cell line, knocked out the other, and now we're collecting this protein from the cells.
Nice.
And we have pure because the cells are only making one. If he screwed up half the cell with CRISPR, who cares?
Right.
Right? So the fact that CRISPR is imperfect, it's just still a huge advantage for research.
Right.
And all these questions
for building years, models that wouldn't have been possible earlier. Yeah. So that leads into my next point, which I love that you mentioned that, because what they say is, now I lost it. Okay.
Is this in the section, why isn't CRISPR ready for prime time?
So, one of the things that, I totally lost what I was going to say. There's the hope that it could be used for, drugs on living, you know, people without, for diseases such as muscular dystrophy and cystic fibrosis for corrective genes. Correcting genes in living persons. Okay.
Right. That would not be necessarily germline. It'd be directly.
Right. Directly on the person.
Changing one person's somatic cells.
What I And like you were saying before, this is something that's been very difficult, because if they do it outside the person and then try to place them in, very few cells live. You have problems with, you know, all kinds of just technical issues in the whole process, right? And their hope is that CRISPR could be used in this way. It's not ready yet, but that's, you know, the hope for the future. So totally not ready for that.
No.
But it's just an interesting idea that flows along with, right now in research, the capability to do specific tests to answer questions is much easier because of the specificity of that particular project. But with people, we're still working on it.
Although, you know, I think it was last time that you mentioned about the FDA approving, in the United States, approving the use of
mushroom,
that's what it was, right? So that's a little bit the same way. You have some characteristic in a food that you want to do. You use CRISPR on the germline for that plant or whatever, and you modify it, and let's say you mess up a bunch of stuff. But actually, it's not stuff you care about, right?
Right.
It's stuff that has to do with maybe reproduction.
Right.
Or I don't know what. But what you're interested in as a farmer or whatever, it actually makes a better product. The fact that CRISPR has these off-target effects and stuff like that may not matter at all.
Right.
You know? And so for actually stuff that are going to be products that are out there, it's going to show up.
Right. So you're right. It's with, you know, they do have off-target effects, and those off-target effects aren't important in some cases and vital in other situations. Right. So I'm interested to see what they, what comes out of the meeting.
Yep.
And I think it's just, you know, it's something that will continue to pop up in our podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
Each time.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to get to a point where there's
no need research to mention it. It's just the specifics.
Right. There's going to be research where people find new things, right?
Right.
And they'll have used CRISPR. And we don't even realize it.
Right.
Because it just wasn't. Anyway.
So.
Cool. Staying on science?
Staying on science.
My turn?
Yep.
Okay. We're going to, I think this is going to be a shorter podcast.
Oh, it will be.
Yeah. It's already past 11.
Yeah.
I'm getting hungry. Anyway, maybe if we talk really, really fast. Okay. I'll do this one first. I only have two science articles. I just picked them. I read more than that, but those are the ones that I picked. The first one, starting more physics side. Actually, they're both about physics, but one's more about policy and stuff. So Kepler, first what this is about. This is about the spacecraft Kepler that's been used to hunt for exoplanets. And it's from an article out of the April 29th issue of Science, page 504. It's a news piece. And so this there's a background story to this, which is very short, but I love these stories about, you know, what's happening during the research. So normally the way Kepler works is that you have light coming to you from distant stars, and basically Kepler's a telescope, and it looks at the star and it tracks it over time, and sometimes the light from the star will suddenly dip down a bit, stay a little bit, just slightly low, just by like a fraction of a percent, and then come back. And that's because usually a planet is orbiting the star that you're looking at, and the planet just came in front, between you and the star as it's orbiting around that distant star. Right? So then you're like, okay, so we can tell probably how much of the star is being masked by the planets. So we've got the disk, and there's all sorts of calculations that go into it, and you can figure out how far it is from the star, its orbit, and how massive it is. And that's the typical Kepler data. And it's been finding all sorts of exoplanets, right? And I think it was, it's in here, I think it's in 2003. Let me double check. I'm going to go down and I can't find it. Nope. 2013. Yeah. Actually, 2003. That's a long time ago. It couldn't be that. But anyway, in 2013. So Kepler has reaction wheels inside, which are basically those spinning wheels. And you spin it one way, it's got mass, and the aircraft spins the other way. And right. So that's, you can control how it points that way with just, you know, I guess electricity from, I don't know what its power source is. And so it has a bunch of these. And in 2013, it lost two of them. So there's, it still has some, and they're able to point the telescope, but they only have this narrow band across the sky that they can use. Because I guess it would be too much work. Like, maybe they'd have to use, I don't know, if there's thrusters or what, but pointing out of that range is no good. Well, in the next few months, it's going, that band is going to pass through the our galactic bulge from the Milky Way. And this is important. Okay, so what? So what's this new use that they're going to use Kepler for? It's still hunting for exoplanets. But they're going to use microlensing, you know, the gravitational lensing. But it's microlensing. So it's lensing from small objects instead of just galaxies or galaxy clusters.
Yeah.
Right? And the way it works goes like this. If you have a star that's far away and something closer to you passes in front of it, then light that was normally going away from you gets bent and goes towards you. And so as you look at it, even if you don't can't see that object, as it passes in front, that star that's way in the distance, it'll look like it gets slightly brighter, and then the brightness will drop down again. And people have been using this with ground-based telescopes since... so they started looking at, I'm going to go from memory, I think in the 1980s they started to look at microlensing, and in the 1990s they started to look for planets that way. And the way you look at planets, and wait, no, was it planets? Okay, in the 1980s, if I remember correctly, I should make sure, it should be easy to check right here. 1980s, dim, faint stars of Earth. Okay, so the 1980s, they were looking for very faint stars, so brown dwarfs. So you look at a star that's very far from you, and a brown dwarf is basically a star that's it's so small that it can't quite get nuclear fusion really going.
Right.
So it's putting out a lot of heat. But it's mostly from, I guess, gravitational collapse. And maybe there's a bit of fusion, but it's not really got a good start. So I'm not sure exactly where the division is. But it might be, even though it's closer to you, it might be too faint to see.
Right.
And in the 1990s, then, they must have started to look for exoplanets. And they've found, a few dozen, I don't know. Maybe more than that. Maybe it's thousands. But with Kepler... it's going to be totally different because Kepler is way far from the Earth and it's got no atmosphere to contend with. And it's designed on purpose just to look for these light curves over time. So what it looks for is I don't totally understand this, because if a star is closer to you than the far star, then you should see it when they pass in front.
Right.
Right? But the article, I think, simplified that a bit. But basically... if you can think of just the star you're getting from the distant star, if another star passes in front, then, and you don't worry about the light you're getting from that star, the light from the far star, its light curve is going to be at a certain level, and then it's going to go up and then come back down. And that up is from the microlensing. Well, if... that star that's between you and the far one, and maybe it's a brown dwarf, so you don't see it. So let's, if that's easier to think, if you think of that way, if it has a planet orbiting it, then let's say the planet is at the leading edge of the direction it's going. Mm-hmm. Then when the planet, you'll get microlensing, so you get increased light from the far star.
Right.
And then you're going to get a little bump as the planet passes in front.
Got it.
And you get a little bump and then comes back to where that big increase was, and then it goes up and then goes back down. So you get a complicated light curve like that. You've just identified a planet orbiting a star.
Got it.
And they were all set. This is where the story comes in. They were all set to do like an 8-month experiment. Microlensing is really good if you're going to look at the galactic bulge, because there's tons of stars and planets there. It's much denser. So your chance of hitting a star and then another star behind it, and the star in front has a planet around it and all of it lining up, chances are much better if you're looking at a field with many more stars in it.
Right.
And so that's why that was going to be a really exciting time and why they planned it for that time. And I don't know how long before, I think it was just like a week before, suddenly Kepler went into emergency shutdown.
Oh.
And they couldn't, I don't know what happened with it, but finally they just got regained control. They say here hours before it was to begin an 80-day microlensing campaign as it passes through the galactic bulge. So they're all like, yippee.
Wow.
Anyway, it was a cool story.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit more in that. Because Kepler is so far away from the Earth, it's 120 million kilometers, they say. And because we can observe the same stars from Earth, they're getting all of these telescopes on Earth to try to coordinate with Kepler. Mm-hmm. And they can do some parallax measurements. And they'll be able to tell from calculations that are more than just parallax, but having the two different telescopes, where those exoplanets are,
mm-hmm.
because you're looking at the distant star, not at the planet, right?
Right.
And possibly its mass and other information about it.
Nice.
Yeah. And one thing that's amazingly cool is we don't know what the planet distribution is far from the mm-hmm. sun, because from the stars, because the regular Kepler data is good at picking up stars, planets that are in a small orbit around their star. But if it's farther away, it just doesn't pick them up.
Right.
While the microlensing system using Kepler will really pick those up well. Or, I mean, it'll pick them up just as well as it would inner ones. So we're going to get all these stats on what truly the statistics are of planets around stars, where right now we only know for really short orbit ones or small orbit ones. The other thing that's really cool is, I guess there's some data out there that's kind of, it's really rough, so we're not sure if this is correct, but it looks like maybe there's all these rogue planets out there. They're not orbiting anything. They're just flying through space by themselves. And there might be twice as many of them as there are stars.
Wow.
And Kepler might be able to pick some up.
Oh, wow.
Right? Because if they're just flying all over the place, yeah. and you see a sharp blurb yeah. that's sharper than a star could make, like a brown dwarf.
Right. You're
like, whoa, you know,
yeah.
that's a planet.
Right.
And there's nothing there. So, and then the last thing about it is, like, in way distance future, like a decade from now, we got another telescope that's going to go up. It's called the Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope, WFIRST acronym, I guess. And it's going to be even more powerful than Kepler. So, exciting, cool stuff.
Neat.
Anyway, that was the Kepler one.
Well, I have an article that goes along with
that,
surprisingly enough. So, we are getting some more information about the whole project that they're doing around the drilling project, where they have a drilling platform where they're looking at the rim of the
Yucatan
Peninsula.
Yeah,
crater.
We talked about that.
Yeah.
Was it last or two podcasts ago? I can't
right.
remember.
So they have some more information about it. Not a lot, but it's pretty cool.
The peak ring.
Yep. So they've been looking at the peak ring. So here's the cool thing. So the peak ring, the reason why it's kind of, or their focus is on the peak ring, is because peak rings are found on the moon, Mars, Mercury, you know, all these different planets.
Yeah.
And if they're able to gather information about it, they will learn more about how they're formed and be able to better.
Right, because you can't drill down into a peak ring on Mars.
Right, you
there's,
can't.
There's no one there to drill.
But with the information about this peak ring, we could talk about what the meteor must have looked like that made the peak ring on other planets.
And the mechanism of how a peak ring forms.
Exactly.
That's the funny thing is they're doing, it's basically astronomy.
Yes,
it's research on what happens in these impacts and far, you know, in planets
and
stuff. But it's by doing drilling on Earth.
Yeah, I know. So I didn't really put that all together so strongly until now. And so what I thought was cool is the peak ring formed in a matter of minutes just after the impact of the deep granite bedrock flows like a liquid, rebounding into the central tower as tall as 10 kilometers before collapsing in a circular ridge.
Right.
Can you imagine? And they, it's just, you know, to really think through that. So as they're going down, they're like, whoa, this rock is the rock that, you know, was liquefied at this point.
Yeah.
And they can determine that. And then think about, you know, okay, so
how... Is there a diagram?
Yeah, Chris. I was going to...
Because we had a diagram last time we talked about it. Right.
So
when the central peak collapses...
Right.
And the outer edge... So the central peak collapses and pushes out...
Right.
When it comes back down.
Right.
And then the stuff you pushed out during the impact, that collapses back in.
Right.
And then when wherever they hit... is where you get the peak ring, right? Okay.
So, and then another interesting point that they made is that, okay, so this all happens in a short period of time, followed by a tsunami that, you know, totally rocks all the ocean. And, but what I thought, and it's just mentioned in passing, and I can't find the specifics right now, but what they said is, you know, the redevelopment or rebound of Earth, of life on Earth, could actually be a combination of microbes that were traveling on this meteor as well.
That's
and
an
so I was like, yeah, that's kind of neat and, you know, interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was mentioned
very briefly. Did they mention... I mean, one of the idea was to confirm that hypothesis, right?
Right. And so...
Is that what they're saying is there's evidence for that particular hypothesis?
For the life or the rebound?
The
rebound.
The peak ring being formed by the...
That's what they're working on now.
So they found the rocks.
Yeah.
They're getting
found
the data,
rocks. They're getting the data.
And they're analyzing.
Okay. And honestly, it's just collecting and... It was really fun because I just want to say this one point before you go on. So when they talked to the co-chief scientist, Sean Gullick, in the interview, I'm not getting much sleep out here, so we're a little delirious. And, you know, I just thought, wow, it really speaks to... the excitement about working so hard to develop a project that I think it's over 10 years in development that this project has been set, designed. And
also, he's got a certain amount of time for that. Because that ship puts down pylons to become a platform, and then it's going to leave.
Right, exactly.
So they have a certain amount of time to collect the data.
Right.
And it's almost like I don't care what we're getting. Just let's get as much as we can.
We'll have time afterwards to analyze.
Figure it out. Yeah. Yeah. Let's not miss something yeah. because we're trying to do analysis in our. Right.
And I had to mention it before you went on because there's something about having, you know, a project dream come to reality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure.
And to just be able to go with it and try to get as much out of the experience as possible.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you go on. I didn't mean to stop you.
No, I was just trying to remember what it was. I don't remember. There was a short description last time we talked about it. About what you could find that would be evidence for that collapse. And I think it was if you found different types of rock, some from the meteorite, which would be part of the liquefied center, and some from the crust, I think, which would be the outside coming back in, mixed one on top of the other.
So
if they find many layers that are out of order, that would be evidence for the hypothesis we've talked about. Okay.
So, and they talk a little bit about that. Last week, at a depth of 620 meters, when drillers left fossil-containing limestone layers, entered sandy tsunami deposits. So you have this whole chaos happening within... you know, hours of each other. So they are going down, they're finding things. But again, you know, the information that they're getting, like that they're sharing right now is more of just
I think they remember also that at a certain layer they thought that there'd be a lot of places where there'd be latent heat and there'd be more pores in the rock, and they thought like they might find bacteria and stuff that have developed in there for millennia but have been kind of trapped down there or something. I don't remember. But I remember they were going to look for biological...
That might be right here, Pat.
Yeah?
Okay. Some of the minerals they found suggest that initially at least the fluid-filled cracks were way too hot for life.
Too hot, okay.
But they are hoping to find some signs of ancient or modern DNA. As hellish as the impact was, the team suspects the buried peak rings itself may have been an early place for life to return because of the nutrients in the hot fluid-filled fractures.
Right.
So that you were right about that. So
they're going to look for it.
Yep. And the 1st of May, the team hit a depth of 700 meters and it found the drill. And they think when they move deeper into the harder granite of the peak ring, they will core more slowly and obtain 3 meters of core about every 2 hours.
Yeah.
So... it's just like...
Well, they're planning to go to 1,500 meters. Wow.
Yeah.
So they got a ways to go still.
They have a ways to go, and that will take them into June.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Cool.
So...
Oh, I'm interested in seeing that show up again.
Yeah. So... okay.
Man, this makes me angry. I can just feel that I'm just going to be reading that article when it gets published in the actual journal, and you get to see it first every time.
Well, I was really excited when I noticed that it was really something that we had, so I was like, ooh, I have to read about it.
Okay.
So,
that's... one of mine?
Yep.
Okay. This is my last thing.
That was my last.
Okay. So this is actually kind of a funny thing, but, you know, Iran had their nuclear weapons program, and then they got shut down because of all of the sanctions. Finally, they decided they couldn't take it, and there was an agreement. So this is the funny thing. There's a plant, an Iranian plant at Arak, A-R-A-K. And they were making heavy water there. And they were also, like, I think most heavy water plants can also make with a little modification, they can make plutonium.
Oh.
Which, if you're making plutonium, you're making weapons, right?
Right.
And I think that was part of their plans and stuff. So as part of the agreement, they had to shut down the plutonium stuff, and they're getting help to change that. But they still have this heavy water they're making there. And they have 130... What is it? I can't find it. Let me see. 130 tons of heavy water there. I can't find it. Anyway, I'm pretty sure it's 130 tons. And they figured, well, we'll sell it, right? And they couldn't find enough people to buy the heavy water. And the United States Department of Energy, after all the settled about the sanctions and everything, they started to realize, hey, we need heavy water. And they just made this agreement. They're going to buy 32 tons of heavy water from Iran. The United States is for $8.6 million. Wow. Isn't that wild? That's so cool. Anyway, I think it's really cool.
It is.
And right now, the U.S. is not making any heavy water.
Mm-hmm.
Should we stop?
No.
Okay. And there's only two places in the world still making them. The last U.S. place to make it, I think they shut down. It was a while ago. Canada makes a huge amount. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember where the other place is. And U.S. buys up most of the world demand, but other places do. And it's mostly for industry. It's used in all sorts of different things. And heavy water is just the deuterium isotope of water. So I think I will... I'll just say where it's from. It's from also the April 29th issue of Science, page 503. And there's a lot more there. But I think we're going to keep this one a bit shorter.
Yeah.
So
I thought we should recap some of the things that we've been doing.
That's the biggest part in a way, yeah. But I think we'll still keep it short. Yeah. I see your blog entries are listed as 66 and 67, but we're way beyond that.
Well, I lost track of numbers.
Oh, yeah. We're at... right now... We're on 68 and 69.
Oh, sorry.
And I still have to put yours up as soon as you finish. That'll be 70.
Mm-hmm.
And mine is due today, and that'll be 71.
Wow.
So.
Okay. My blog is actually part of a thank you that I'm writing for Donors Choose.
Uh-huh.
And I worked on a project that a student helped me write the grant for,
mm-hmm.
and then he implemented, called the Sparrow's Heroes Project.
Yeah.
And so we made a maze to teach physics to students that the students try to drive their sparrows through.
Uh-huh.
And that's been a big success. It's one of those things I'm like, hey, Eli, so today, don't forget, you have to go to the media center because you're going to be doing your teach out, right? He's like, oh, yeah, that'll be fun. And you know what I mean? So it's never a struggle to get them to share out or anything. We both just have to remember the commitments we made.
Right.
You know? Yeah. But he's like really joyful about it and going to pick it up and set it up. So it's been a very nice project for me to work on with him. So the other thing that Pat and I did together...
Are you talking about last Saturday?
Yeah.
Oh, this is the biggest one.
Yeah, it was. And so it was the ARTIF event, our first big event.
Our first full
event.
Full course.
Yeah, full course.
With start, finish, five foxes.
Right.
A homing beep and people going out on the course timed and coming back.
Yeah.
Finish shoot.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yep. Yeah.
That was really cool.
It was. And it was... crazy.
And we have an event report.
Yeah.
Where's the webpage? Okay, so it's in the Island CT Projects.
Yeah.
And it is called, well, I mean, it's, the link says 2016-04-30 SMS for Smith Middle School ARDF event report.
Right.
And yeah, there's pictures of, so we had four teams
right.
go out, mm-hmm. and we had a total, I think, of nine people. I wrote it up a little right. while ago. So.
And it was very
had a
sweet.
Late start.
We did.
Didn't realize it's going to take me 3 hours with your broken foot. It's
yeah. So
still recovering. It's,
yeah.
It's going to take me. I mean, you can walk, but you shouldn't be running. And so it's all
yeah.
on me.
Yeah, it's
but
all
then,
on Pat.
But then setting up the place is yeah. all on you.
Right. So we both thought we had tons of time. And in fact, yeah. we had so much time, we were going to set up and probably run out, get a coffee, come back and have it.
I know.
Hang out, right?
No.
And it got a little crazier than we expected. And we both, I finished just in time for people to arrive.
I have to say, I'm sorry. I totally screwed up the explanation. I got confused halfway through and thought, like when I was teaching the class,
yeah,
I thought you'd already gone over some of the stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't go over
the null.
Actually, basically the most important information. How do you know what direction
you're going in? Yeah.
The transmitter is. And then I get to the starting line with one of the families.
Yeah.
And like, so you know about, you know, how to find them. And I realized, oh, no, they don't know. Oh, my God. Okay. Let's go over this. And they did really well. I think they found
did.
Two, didn't they?
They found two.
So.
And they did very well, considering he had two kids and a dog.
I know.
Yeah. So it was
and great. The timing was totally screwed up because I didn't have time to put out transmitter number one.
Right.
And if it had been any other one, I wouldn't have never thought of this. But I thought, well, okay, fine. We'll start them out on minute number two.
Right.
Like that, when they start, they can hear something right away instead of silence.
Right.
Man, that caused so much confusion. It was like we were at it for 10 minutes trying
right.
to. And so, yeah, that was not.
So the day itself, I think we might have even had a few more people if it looked sunny.
Yeah.
So it looked like it was going to threaten to downpour at any point, but it never really did.
No,
and
it was good.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean?
You think
if
there
you
would
are
have been,
brave.
Because there were several people we thought were going to be there,
yeah.
and they never showed up.
Right, and I think even the parents that did show up, they were hesitant. One person saw me in the parking lot so her friend could call her and verify that, yes, it was still going.
Yeah.
And so I think the weather was one of the holders of it.
Maybe
but
we
the
should
people,
put on the announcement, rain or shine.
Yeah. The people that do go were really excited.
You know, the neat thing is, even though some people had a lot of problems in the beginning, everybody came back really excited.
Yeah.
And you remember the little girl with the one family? And she, we're talking about, you know, what they found. And then she screams out, I found number five. I'm like, oh, wow, that's good, right? 2 minutes later, and I found five, number five. I'm like, dad, that's great. It was really important that she was the one and not her older brother that had found number five. She must have been the first one to see it.
Yeah, I think so. She must have saw the flag.
She must have
saw
the flag.
Once she figured out that she just had to look for a flag, once they were close, she must have just been scouring the landscape.
Yeah.
Which is great. So it was nice. I thought that it's funny. We had really nice parent student teams.
Yep.
And then we had a student team. And it, I don't know, it really made me feel good that there were both.
And one thing that's really exciting is it's the first time we collected money.
Yeah.
And that's going to the Smith Middle School ARDF Club.
Right.
Which means that soon they'll be getting their own equipment.
Right.
So
that's
really
exciting. So we're halfway to one receiver.
Halfway to one. But that's fine because
that's good.
We'll
build up.
We'll keep supporting them until they have everything they
need.
So.
Right. So it was nice and we enjoyed it. And now we know. You know, until you do something the first time, you have no idea how much time it takes.
Yeah.
And,
oh, so the transmitters? Plastic, thin plastic shoebox. It doesn't matter how nice you try to make it. That is not going to work. I spent a lot of hours remaking the enclosures to those. I actually just got it finished only yesterday. And yeah, that's pretty important to have something that's nice and sturdy if you're going to be going out in the woods with it.
Oh yeah, definitely. Because also, it has to be stuffed in a backpack.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. And you don't want anything that can open easily or get cracked easily. Totally agree. So yeah, that was a good time, and it was nice to see everyone go through it.
And then yesterday, you just came. Are we done with this, the art of stuff? Except to mention we have another
one coming up in 3 weeks. And hopefully we get a few more people. I will be very excited to get a few more people. And we just like to see it grow and get more people involved in art of. So the next thing that I just came back from.
Yeah, you just came back yesterday.
Yeah, that's why I blocked out on late podcast. I was at Bear Island with students. We were supposed to go with a larger group of students. And then as it got closer, for some students, they became fearful about camping. And then they just decided they weren't going to go. And some students, they got kind of strange about it. And they thought that by not going, that we would somehow change it so we would stay in a hotel.
Right.
And I think that was their whole game plan. And it was too bad because they didn't realize that it was the camping experience. That's the point. That we liked. So it was like, it was a challenge. And it did not turn out as well as we wanted for the number of students that went.
And but say what happened for those that did, because...
But those that did go, they were so fantastic. And all as they did is just look and look. And just their curiosity was wonderful. And in fact, to the point where they woke up at 2:30 in the morning to go out and look on the beach at low tide to see what was around, but it was too cold for anything to be up.
I think that has to be explained a little bit. We figured out after, I mean, it wouldn't have made a difference, but we figured out when you're going to be there.
Right.
You're going to arrive. By the time you get to the beach, it'll be high tide.
Right.
Then it's low at...
Or in between low and high tide. So it's not as interesting for looking for life.
And then
life.
Low was going to be 2:30 in the morning.
2:30 in the morning.
And then high tide in the morning.
Right.
And then you leave.
And then we leave.
So.
And then we leave right in that in between high and low tide. Yeah. So it wasn't ideal for looking for things. But we had a certain time frame to stick to.
We had
students that were going out camping for the first time.
Right.
And we didn't want to make it a 2-day and then maybe have people that suffered.
Yeah.
So the students that did go were very excited, and they were troopers. We had the attack of the gnats. We all had to wear hoods and cover our faces so you could only see our eyes pretty much. And they suffered through it.
How long did that last?
For about an hour.
About an hour.
Hour.
was that in the evening?
Yeah. When wind dropped down and we got attacked by insects.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Well, so say more because...
Okay.
That 2:30 in the morning, looking for stuff actually didn't turn out, but else did.
2:30 in the morning, we realized it was too cold and we didn't find anything. Yeah. But it was cool to see how far out the water went
because
it
was
a spring tide.
Is neat.
Spring tide, and the kids were like, "Wow, look how far!" Pardon me, but the stars were incredible, and we could see the Milky Way like no other.
Yeah.
And
there's no lights on Bear Island.
And there were two teachers other than me on the trip, and they were just taken by the stars. They were both like...
I wish I could have gone on that trip.
Yeah. Now I was like, Pat could be calling out the different stars. and that. Yeah. But, and it was really cool because it's over the ocean, so your view of lightning and thunderstorms, or lightning storms is what you can see, is... just incredible, even though you can't hear any thunder. So they're like miles and miles away from you. So no indication that we're going to be hit by it.
Yeah.
And you can see this wonderful light show far out in the water. Yeah. And it looked like there was some kind of war going on out in the waters.
And you remember before you went out, I think it's really great that they got to see the stars like that, mm-hmm. because you can't explain it to someone, from the city point of view. And I'd looked up the moon phase and I'm like, oh no,
yeah.
You're going to have a new moon. And I was like, well, you know, you can't see anything on the beach like that, right? But it actually turned out to be way better. There was nothing on the beach anyway.
Yeah, right.
And then with a new moon, the stars just don't look as good.
Right.
So.
And.
I mean, with a new moon, the stars look a lot better.
Yeah.
Right? With a full moon, they don't look as good.
Right. Right. So. The other thing, we got a few falling stars, meteors.
So they got to see those. That was nice.
Yeah. So.
That's cool.
And then the next morning, they got up really early. And they went and took pictures of the sunset, or the sunrise.
That's neat.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah, that's neat.
And that was self-initiated. And, it was just nice. They were showing us the pictures in the morning as we're eating breakfast. So,
do you think that might be your next blog entry?
I think I will write about it, and probably it will be the next. Yeah.
That might be cool.
Yep.
Or you could make it as a project page if you still want an outlet for the stuff. And
Yep. So that's everything.
That's everything. Let me get back. So are we done?
Yep. But we are looking forward to setting up for our May 28th event.
Yep.
We hope to have more parents and student teams. I thought that was just fun and great.
Yeah, the teams worked out really well.
Yeah, and more student teams. Both are just awesome.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure to check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.